Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The Jewish celebration of Hanukkah, which means dedication in Hebrew, commemorates the rededication during the 2nd century BC of the Second Temple in Jerusalem, where, according to legend, Jews had risen up against their Greek and Syrian oppressors in the Maccabean Revolt. Hanukkah begins every year on the 25th day of Kislev and usually falls in November or December in the Gregorian calendar. The Jewish calendar is based on lunar cycles, and Hanukkah, often called the Festival of Lights, always starts 5 days prior to the last new moon before the winter solstice. Thanksgiving is a celebration common to cultures and religions worldwide, often celebrated after harvest. It's held in the United States on the fourth Thursday of November each year. In this, the Hebrew calendar year of 5,774 and the Gregorian calendar year of 2013, these two holidays converge, with Thanksgiving falling on the second day of Hanukkah. Thus, some people will eat latkes, also known as potato pancakes, with turkey and or stuffing. In this edition of Radio Curious, we combine two archive editions and tell the story of two very fun holidays. We start with our 2011 conversation with Mark Binder, author of A Hanukkah Present, followed by a 2002 conversation with Professor Hugo Freund about the history of Thanksgiving in the United States. We begin with Mark Binder explaining the purpose of telling stories around Hanukkah.
The purpose, as far as I'm concerned, of telling stories around Hanukkah is the same reason you would tell stories at any other time of year, which is to bring people together and to share whatever culture you're part of. So if you're not Jewish and you want to share your own stories, or if you're not Jewish, maybe you want to read some of these stories in my book, because it's a way of communicating directly from person to person that doesn't necessarily happen if you just read things to yourself. I'm not a particularly religious person, so I don't actually tell or write any stories to promote a religious perspective. The stories that I write, for example, my Helm stories, I've written a lot of stories in the village of Helm, are not religious, except that the people in the stories are religious. So they're really written for anyone to enjoy, because I don't write just for Jewish people. I don't write just for young people. I was thinking just before I got on the air that my ideal reader would the best way I could imagine somebody reading my Hanukkah book would be to be frying up latkes, potato pancakes, while your grandmother or your mother reads the stories to your kids, and your daughter is snuggled in next to her on one side, and your older son is on the other side, and the teenager is sitting across the room, and he puts down his cell phone and stops texting and listens. That would be my ideal scenario. And so stories communicate orally in the same way that radio does. It just connects you to the other person.
In the oral tradition that stories bring to voice, are there particular themes that you find repeated, whether they be stories of any one particular culture or perhaps not?
In a lot of my work, I've noticed that there are themes of poverty and a joyful life in spite of poverty. And that's something that I noticed really only I'd been telling the stories for a while, but as we entered this recession, I noticed that those themes were there in a lot of the stories.
What would be an example of a story that makes the best out of a grim situation, and poverty as your example?
In my collection, A Hanukkah Present, there's a story called The Hanukkah Duck, which I wrote for my daughter. I'd she was very young, and I'd been writing a lot of stories for the boys who are a little older. And so I wrote this story for my daughter, and it's about a duck. In the village of Chelm, there's a cobbler, and he's a really good cobbler. He makes wonderful shoes, which means that if you buy a pair of his shoes, you don't need to buy another pair for years, which means he's very poor. So everyone else in the village has animals, but they don't have any. They can't afford even to keep animals. And one evening during Hanukkah, a duck shows up at their house, and it's sort of a magical duck. And each time the duck tries to help them out, something else happens and gets in the way until finally, you know, goodness and light prevail.
Well, Mark Binder, author of A Hanukkah Present, would you be able to read the story of the Hanukkah duck for us?
Sure, I'll read a little bit of it. Let me see if I can find it in the book here. Here we go. The youngest was a girl, and she was the favorite. Her name was Faggy Shoshana, and everyone called her Little Bird. "Daddy, why don't we light the candles now?" Faggy asked on the first night of Hanukkah. "Everyone else in Chelm already has candles in their window." Her mother sighed, "Little Bird, we don't have any Hanukkah candles." "We have Sabbath candles. Can't we light them?" Esther Gold looked at her husband. Joshua Gold shrugged. "Why not?" So the whole family gathered around as the Hanukkah blessings were sung and the Sabbath candles were lit. "But what shall we do for candles for tomorrow night?" whispered Esther Gold to her husband. "And what will we do for candles for the Sabbath? Those were our last two." "Shh," he answered quietly. "We'll worry about that tomorrow. Look how happy they are." The two parents smiled together as they saw the faces of their children bathed in the warm glow of the candles. And it goes on. It's a nice story. I had forgotten that part. When I tell the story, that part, it's really interesting as a writer who tells stories. The spoken versions of my stories are not word-for-word readings. So parts of them drop out, and I had completely forgotten that part. I tell this story fairly often, and that hasn't been in it, and I really like that part. I may have to put it back into the spoken version.
The concept of that part is, let's celebrate with what we have today, and tomorrow something else will appear and allow us to celebrate with it.
Exactly, and that is what happens in this particular story. The duck shows up with a brass dreidel, which they then sell, and so on.
In preparing your collection of stories, A Hanukkah Present, being 12 stories to give and share, did you have an overall or a leading intention?
Well, these are stories that I've written over time. Every year, almost every year, I write a new Hanukkah story, and I send it out to friends, and I've sent them out to newspapers throughout the country, throughout the world, actually, they've been published. And as I was putting the collection together, it was interesting trying to shape it, because some of the stories came earlier than others, and some of the stories build on others. And then my publisher came to me and said, well, we've got these great stories, and we'd really like to make the first edition hardcover, but we don't have enough pages. Can you write something else? So I spent some time, and I wrote, there's a novella that finishes off the book that takes all of the characters and all of the stories in the book and ties them all together in an adventure.
Mark, many of the stories that you have concern food. Can you relate that to the story itself? Obviously, we all like to eat well, so I guess a story about good food would fit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a couple of things. The story of Hanukkah has in it a miracle surrounding oil. And so because of that, there is a permission given to eat anything that's fried. So potato latkes, potato pancakes, are very popular on Hanukkah. And there's a story of the lethal latkes in the book about these horrible potato pancakes. But one of the stories that I really like is a story that I like to tell on Fridays. It's called The Challah That Ate Chelm. And in the context of the story, the thing that it has to do with Hanukkah is because it's Hanukkah time and they add extra oil into the challah. But the story came because once I was making challah and I was working on a recipe. I didn't know how to bake at all. And I got a recipe from a baker, and I didn't read it first. So I dumped into my KitchenAid mixer 6 cups of water, and then I started adding all the other ingredients in the flour. And if you've ever baked in a KitchenAid mixer, 6 cups of water is a lot of water. And the dough started to come out very quickly out of the mixer, and it went all over the counter. And the bread was delicious, and I cut the recipe down, but I came up with the idea of the challah that ate chelm, which is a story of what happens when the baker's apprentice, who is a complete disaster, adds an entire bag of yeast because he forgot to order the flour. And it overwhelms the village.
How does it overwhelm the village? Can you fill us in?
What happens is, let me find it in the book and I'll read it to you. Or I can tell it. Which would you prefer?
Why don't you read it to us?
Okay, here we go. Muddle the apprentice has mixed an entire bag of yeast into the bread dough, and then he went to sleep in the bakery, which is where he slept. And this is a moment later. What's he doing here? Said one voice. What's that thing pushing him down the street? Said another. Who cares? Said a third. Run! Muddle opened his eyes and was surprised to find himself rolling like a barrel down the middle of Helm's Main Street with something pushing at his back every time he slowed. It's a dream, he thought, closing his eyes, until suddenly with a bump, Muddle hit a rock and was launched high into a tree. He grabbed onto a branch and hung on for dear life. Of course, by then he had reopened his eyes. What he saw was incredible. The main street of Helm was covered with a deep white goop. Villagers were cowering in doorways or peering out of windows. The ooze was growing and spreading and getting bigger still. From his perch, Muddle could see the goop seeping through the entire village. It seemed to be originating from the windows and doors of Reb Stein's bakery. This is a silly dream, Muddle thought. He reached over to pinch himself and fell right into the muck. It smelled like dough. It tasted like dough. That's when he realized it was no dream.
It was actually too much yeast.
It was too much yeast. It's a little bit of a tall tale.
Mark Binder, what are you working on now?
I'm working on four different projects right now. The Bedtime Storybook 2 is something that's going to be coming out hopefully in the future. We just released a collection called Stories for Peace, Resolving Conflicts and Handling Bullies, which is based on a program that I do in schools. I studied Aikido, which is a martial art for peace, for many, many years, and we collected those in a book. So I'm working on promoting that book and getting that program into schools and communities and theaters and things like that. I'm working on a novel, and then I just wrote a piece the other day that I was invited to give a talk to the Visiting Nurses Association at their holiday party. And I had just seen Bill Irwin perform. Bill Irwin is a wonderful physical comedian and a clown. He was talking about old age. And so I wrote a short story for, as if Bill Irwin was in it, about an old man and a nurse. And I read that to them the other day. It was a neat experience.
Can you give us a piece of that?
This is the scene. It's toward the end of the story, when the old man has asked the nurse to help him up, and he sort of stops her, and he stands up, and this is how it goes. He thought about collapsing back, about admitting defeat, but then he would not remember the last time. Then he would be done. Then he would be defeated and dead, just waiting for the breath to go from his body. So he took the breath, and he felt his heart, and he listened to the music begin to play in his head. And he danced. She watched his feet move, at first uncertain whether he was trying to walk or trying to catch himself from falling. She leaned forward, but he held his hand up to keep her at bay. His right foot moved, his heel and his toe, his left foot moved, and then he danced. His body was old and out of practice and out of shape, but the muscles remembered familiar patterns and faint ideas. His blood rushed and his heart beat, eager to keep time with the rhythm, helping to fuel the fond and joyful movement that built and built and built and filled him with strength and the power of memory and the power of motion, not for any other purpose, but for its own sake and beauty. He danced a little, and she watched as time and age dropped away and were suspended. As he moved, he knew she was right, that women had lined up for him to dance anyway, and after that, who knew? Because he moved with ease and authority and passion and love, and then it was gone. Not a sudden collapse, thankfully, but a final gesture of his left hand, and then a slow deflation from a young dancer back into the body of a frail old man.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we just heard from a 2011 conversation with Mark Binder, author of A Hanukkah Present. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. We continue now with a 2002 visit about the roots of Thanksgiving with sociology professor Hugo Freund, recorded in a noisy hotel lobby at the American Anthropology Association meeting in New Orleans, Louisiana. He starts with the rules for celebrating Thanksgiving.
The rules for celebrating the holiday are not specifically religious, although they do invoke patriotism. Thanksgiving is not prescriptive. You have to follow a certain script, but rather in our multifaceted and multicultural life in these United States, what I think Thanksgiving provides instead is a time off, a breathing space.
Well, how has it evolved to be the time off or the breathing space?
Well, that's an enormously complicated question, because even in traditional societies, there was an interest in celebrating when the ingathering of the crops has been successfully accomplished. In other words, societies as a whole have an inclination towards celebrating the fact that they've got enough foods available, presumably to get them through tough times or winter weather or periods of food scarcity.
But that's not the case in modern America for the past 70 or 80 years. The food for Thanksgiving is something that's purchased by most families in the commercial marketplace.
Yeah, and Thanksgiving, like Christmas and some other holidays, have certainly gone through a period of transformation. The historical locale under which they've experienced this transformation, of course, would be the mid-19th century, where these commercial systems of food distribution and the industrialization of food stocks certainly play an important part in how the holiday changed, so that you could find, instead of wild turkeys, domesticated raised turkeys in the markets of the big cities. And instead of hunting your own, which was in some areas an important component of Thanksgiving, you would take your monies and purchase them.
Which is pretty much what happens now.
Oh, yeah. Although in some rural areas to this day, Thanksgiving is not Thanksgiving unless you yourself have gone out and actually hunted the wild turkey and brought it home, or hunted some other ingredient instead.
You talk of a change of the way Thanksgiving was celebrated to the way it is celebrated now.
Right.
Describe that change for us.
Well, I often suggest that there are three or four different threads that have come together to form what we consider to be Thanksgiving. The first thread, I guess, I would describe as cultural, in the sense that the European settlers, particularly the English settlers that first arrived here, brought with them a tradition of feasts and fasting, depending upon the circumstances of the time. During periods of conflict, chaos, or disturbance, you would have a fast. And in fact, there's a wonderful book from the early 20th century called The Feasts and Fasts of Thanksgiving. And it talks about how early New Englanders saw feasting in combination with fasting. In other words, during periods of drought, you would have a fast. During periods of plenty, you would have a festive celebration. And it's within that cultural context that Thanksgiving arose. Subsequently, historical components played a part, consumerism played a part, and politics as well.
Well, let's isolate out those three units, the historical components, consumerism, and politics, with some examples.
Okay. When we talk about Thanksgiving and its transformation, gradually over a period of time, the feasting component separated out from the fasting component and had a life of its own, ultimately resulting in a general sense that once a year you had a day of Thanksgiving in the fall in New England. I would add here that historically Thanksgiving was relatively unknown otherwise, whether it be the Southeast, whether it be the Midwest. Thanksgiving as a national holiday only began to coalesce politically mid-19th century, socially in terms of people actually celebrating it early 20th century. Politically, the piece there is that Sarah Josepha Hale, a noted woman editor and writer, she was part of the group that edited and published Goody's Ladies book, and it became also was known as the Goody's Ladies Women's Magazine. She felt that with growing industrialization, that there had to be a context to celebrate the family and the role that women had in it. And beginning in the 1820s and continuing right through to the American Civil War, she worked to get individual states to proclaim Thanksgiving as a holiday. And gradually, over a period of time, she got more and more states and ultimately territories to make these proclamations. And finally, she approached Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War and suggested it become a national holiday as a way of bringing together the disparate elements that were, at that point, fighting in this terrible, horrific war. When you get to around 1900, 1920, that's the point at which it was becoming a national holiday. But in some quarters it took far longer. Groups in Pennsylvania, like the Pennsylvania Germans, were reluctant to give up their own kind of harvest celebrations, such as Harvest Home, and preferred not to celebrate Thanksgiving.
But the main focus then is the feast and the presentation of the feast that has evolved with certain prescribed foods.
Well, there again, in terms of food consumption and Thanksgiving, it's not remained constant either. Our notion that Thanksgiving should be a large turkey carved by the head of the household and served with cranberries and potatoes and so on. That kind of dietary complex actually is also from, let's say, the mid-19th century.
Well, what was it before then?
Well, it was an evolving kind of menu. If you look at the initial descriptions from the 1620s, when New Englanders first established a toehold at Plymouth Rock, the character of that meal makes no mention of turkeys, for instance. When the king was, the king of the local Indian tribe was invited to celebrate the ingathering of the crops, which were successful that winter after the first winter of tribulations, if it were not for the Indians bringing large deer to be made into venison dishes, as well as duck and some other things, there wouldn't have been a communal festive celebration. In other words, it's not just the food and the menu that is different. The shape of the holiday was different. This was a community celebration. People came together to enjoy the community's company, and the Indians were invited to contribute to that. Here I should say it's based on the work of James Dietz and others who have looked at the ethnogastronomy of the earliest Thanksgiving celebrations. What he found was that this celebration was not of the interior. It was not a familial celebration inside a home. This was a festive celebration of a community sort.
Hugo, the result of the families coming together.
Well, I think that's what an important distinction is between Thanksgiving and Christmas. There have been a number of scholars who have talked about the almost psychological deflation that people feel because their anticipations are not met by the holiday of Christmas. Thanksgiving doesn't have that kind of shape.
The anticipation element is lacking.
Well, the anticipation of gifts and a feeling of well-being and farewell to humankind and the like, often your expectations are not met in terms of what the Christmas celebration is. And a number of scholars have looked at the disappointment psychologically of celebrating Christmas. And I guess what I would suggest is that Thanksgiving does not fall prey to that same kind of process. You don't anticipate certain gifts. You're not concerned about your ability to purchase all that you wish for friends and family. Instead, Thanksgiving is more of a social occasion in which people come together. Gift giving is not a central component. And instead, it's the chance to spend time with one another.
Hugo, let's talk about the nature of the holiday, the content of the holiday. It's flexible. In some cases, it's missing. It doesn't have a religious aspect.
Yeah, that actually was the framework I used when I completed my dissertation. I came to realize that if you expected a set pattern, you would not really engage in the character of the meaning of Thanksgiving for those who are participating in it. In the period when I was first starting this research, and I asked people, I said, "What's your Thanksgiving celebration like?" Some people said, "We don't, because we have a dysfunctional family," and I think that's an important thing to say. And others said that our Thanksgiving celebration is specifically defined by blood and kin. In other words, you cannot attend unless you are either related by blood or by marriage. Other families dictate that any and all can come, and if it's too small, it's not Thanksgiving. I guess my key point here is when we talk about Thanksgiving, it's who is there and how do people make it meaningful. The answers to those questions really are answered by those that come together to celebrate.
Mark Binder is the author of A Hanukkah Present. Hugo Freund is a professor of social and behavioral sciences at Union College in Kentucky. These interviews were recorded in 2011 and 2002. Over 400 Radio Curious programs may be found on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free as my gift to you. I hope you enjoy them. Our address is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. And email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.